This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Raihan Salam's story is the American immigration story at its best. His Bengali parents moved to Brooklyn and achieved the American dream. They sent their son off to the Ivy League. He's now the executive editor of National Review, which is why he says he finds himself both in the middle and on no particular side of America's current deeply fraught immigration politics. Instead, he has a proposal to fix it. He's calling for a new kind of nationalism, which includes limiting immigration and better supporting the American middle class, native and foreign-born. This hour on Point, Raihan Salam's vision for a way forward on immigration. You can join us. What changes do you want to see to the U.S. immigration system? Would a skills-based system work for America, and what would that look like? Or is there something decidedly un-American about not taking in the tired and the hungry? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining me now from Washington is Raihan Salam. He's executive editor of National Review, as I said, and his new book is Melting Pot or Civil War, A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. We have an excerpt at onpointradio.org. Raihan Salam, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It is really great to have you. I want to get deep into your proposal here for a new kind of nationalism. But first, your own personal story and the story of your parents is so compelling. It sort of gives us a framework to understand where you're coming from. So tell us a little bit more about this. When did your family come to the United States and how did they do that?
My parents came in 1976 to settle in the United States. My mother received a skilled visa, and so she was able to bring my sisters and my father as well. My father, however, had in the late 1960s studied in the United States at Indiana University, and he had some experience of the country. And, that informed their decision. Though my mother was more reluctant than my father, it was a kind of complicated question for them both, as they had many loved ones back home. And, I think that's often the case for immigrants, for potential migrants. They're weighing a lot of different considerations, and it's not always a slam dunk.
Mm-hmm. And so growing up then in Brooklyn, how much was being from your parents being from Bangladesh, how much did that influence or inform how you grew up?
Well, it happened in a context. When you look at immigrant stories, you have to look at the really specific aspects of the kind of community they're integrating into, even just the nature of the local economy and much else. And my parents came to Brooklyn at a time when the Bangladeshi community was very small. So we took our cultural heritage very seriously. Eventually, after several years, my parents found a number of friends who were from West Bengal, from India. And those people wound up becoming lifelong friends. It's also the case, however, that the schools I attended were very diverse. There were kids drawn from many different ethnic origins. And so I wasn't really part of an enclave. That's something that has become a more common experience for people in later years. But for me, I wound up being in this very kind of polyglot, diverse environment. And it really eased my way into a broader American culture.
Mm. Well, which is why you talk about in the book that You push back against the notion that all white Americans would be are rabid anti-immigrant.
Well, that's a really important distinction when we talk about being anti-immigrant or being anti-immigration. Mm-hmm. There's a tendency to conflate the two things. But in fact, you'll often find that people who are skeptical about the wisdom of our current immigration policies oftentimes have a lot of goodwill towards individual immigrants. You might think that, we need to have a different, more measured, more humble approach vis-a-vis potential migrants, but those who are already in our country, ensuring that they are able to have upward mobility, to ensure sure that they can integrate into our communities. Those are really two different considerations. And I personally think that it's a mistake to conflate being anti-immigrant with being skeptical about our status quo immigration policies.
Right. Okay. So I want to talk to you just a little bit more about the subtitle of your book, A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. But before we do that, I mean, look, I'm just going, full disclosure, obviously my last name is Chakrabarty, which is also a Bengali name. But my parents immigrated around the same time to the United States from India, not Bangladesh. And, you know, much of your story is very familiar to me. I grew up in Oregon in a community where there weren't very many South Asians at the time. My parents were very, very much in, like, pushed my brother and I to assimilate fully, you know, to the point where they didn't even really speak Bengali in our home. But so they were sort of on one end of the assimilation spectrum, if I can call it that. But even within the sort of smallish South Asian community where I grew up at the time, there were folks who participated much more actively in South Asian culture, etc., but nevertheless did not feel as if they weren't assimilated as well. So I just give that as a background, because what I want to ask you is, you're saying now, use the word enclave, that you're seeing immigrant communities across the United States who, by virtue of what, of their size or what, are less prone or willing to assimilate?
There is a great deal of subtlety and complexity at work here. Recently, you've had a conversation about the debate around affirmative action among Asian Americans. And you've had a number of folks on the left, people who believe that affirmative action is vitally important, who've been dismayed to see that now when you poll Asian Americans, they are less likely to support affirmative action than in decades past. And one straightforward explanation for this, offered by some liberal folks who are immigration advocates, is that you've seen a change in the composition of the Asian American population, in which you have somewhat more affluent Asian Americans, for example, who see affirmative action as something that is a threat to their interests, to their upward mobility. And you see a change in the character of how people look at this. And then some of the discussion has been about this notion, and frankly, you know, this is a very contested notion, that you have some folks, you know, who are chiefly communicating via WeChat. They are part of little ethnic enclaves that are affluent ethnic enclaves, by the way, but that shape their political perspectives in ways that some folks on the left feel puts them at odds with the interests of various other communities. You know, that is one example that you see on the left. And then there are folks on the right who talk about these enclaves in different ways, talking about different groups and about their isolation. But I guess my own belief is that when you're talking about the isolation of any group, whether it is a native minority or an immigrant minority, that can be a real concern because it tends to contribute to segregation and distrust. And I think that that can have knock-on consequences when you're looking at the next generation as well.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a lot of subtlety, and we need to be very precise about what we're talking about.
So let's explore that then more, because I mean, when you talk about these ethnic enclaves, another way of putting it is just sort of large, more concentrated immigrant communities. And I think one can make the case that many of these quote-unquote enclaves over, you know, the 200-plus years of American history as a nation have become, you know, really important parts of the fabric of the cities that they live in. I mean, like, no one's...
Magna, I'm so glad you said that. I'm so glad you're bringing history into this, because it's really important to understand that our history shows that when you have a period when you have a lot of immigrant replenishment, that is oftentimes a period when you don't have a lot of integration. It's when the replenishment slows down that you tend to see intermingling. Consider the Greek towns and Little Italy's that we saw a century ago. Those were flourishing, vibrant communities. They were also communities that tended not to see a lot of intermarriage with people from other ethnic groups. Now, when you saw the replenishment slow down after that, that's when intermarriage, intermingling started to become far more common. This is a pattern we see throughout history. If you look at the early decades of the American Republic, this was a time when the Napoleonic Wars were actually preventing a lot of large-scale migration. So you you saw these large German communities that were very big. Benjamin Franklin was worried about German-speaking enclaves. But the thing is that the Napoleonic Wars actually created some breathing room, and then that in turn led to the kind of intermarriage and intermingling. Mm. When you see our history, the periods when you've had the most melting and fusing of different groups have traditionally been periods when you actually haven't had those very high rates of replenishment. So I think that there's a relationship there. It's a subtle relationship, and you know, one can be crude in talking about it, but there's definitely a relationship between replenishment and the extent to which you see intermingling and integration, yeah, and ultimately intermarriage.
So perhaps, I mean, yeah, I think many historians, lots of them, would agree that we've seen sharp rises in tensions around immigration when we have big waves, and that perhaps those tensions subside as the waves recede. I guess the point that one of the points I was making, though, is like when you look now at many of those formerly, you know, tense enclaves, they are considered to be a part of the fabric of America. I mean, no one's looking at Chinatown in San Francisco and saying that's a bad thing.
Well, Meghna, the subtlety here is actually looking at what happens to the folks who are in those enclaves. Mm-hmm. Are they entering the middle class? Are they incorporated into the elite? Or do they become part of a persistently excluded and marginalized minority? Now, when we talk about assimilation, you know, if you look at Indian immigrants, for example, this is a very interesting and extraordinary group. There is, about 45% of Indian immigrants in the United States are drawn from the 3% of the Indian population that belongs to the uppermost caste groups. The experience of people who are very affluent in India, who have very elite educations in India, when they settle in the United States, that experience is markedly different from that of other folks who don't necessarily have the same capital that they can use to navigate American life. So when we talk about the immigrant experience, when we talk about assimilation, when we're not also talking about class and class stratification in the United States, we miss a really big and important part of the story. Yeah. And as it happens, a lot of the people who are talking about these issues, who are telling these stories, are oftentimes folks who come from the upper strata. And that gives us oftentimes a somewhat mixed picture and also a more sentimental picture than I think is fully appropriate.
Okay, so this is a really important point, and we've just got a minute to go before the break here. Rehan, can you just stand by here for a second? Because I don't want to have to cut you off if I just ask a question all of a sudden. I'm speaking with Rehan Salam. He is the executive editor of National Review and a National Review Institute policy fellow, also contributing editor at The Atlantic and National Affairs. And he's author of the new book, Melting Pot or Civil War, A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. When we come back, we're going to talk to him more about what he thinks needs to be done in America, his new plan for immigration when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're joined today by Rehan Salam. He's executive editor of National Review and author of the new book, Melting Pot or Civil War, A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. Rehan, before the break, we were talking about how you see class being an important part of the picture when we talk about immigration. I mean, pick up on that thought. So what more should we be thinking of if we're going to objectively view class within the context of immigration?
Lots of folks who are in favor of immigration, who have really big hearts, they often want to emphasize what they see as the costlessness of immigration, that really immigration policy is a matter of being open-hearted and decent, and that's all it takes. There's no sacrifice necessary. The tricky thing here is that in a very stratified, in a very unequal society, actually there's a bit more to it. When you have people who might themselves choose to make a leap, to move to another country, even if that means doing work that is difficult, dirty, dangerous work, they feel as though, subjectively, I have made that choice for myself. A really tricky and difficult thing happens in the next generation, when you have the second generation, the native-born children of those immigrants who made that choice for themselves. For those working-class, second-generation people, they grew up in households with very low incomes. They grew up in households that, in some cases, were incorporated into marginalized, segregated communities, and they don't necessarily think of themselves as foreigners. And they shouldn't think of themselves as foreigners. They are Americans, and they expect equal treatment. They expect to at least have a fighting chance at leading decent, dignified middle-class lives. And when we don't have a thoughtful, balanced, and measured approach to immigration, then we risk creating a new underclass that is excluded from the mainstream of society.
Okay, so many questions to ask you here, Raihan. I mean, but first of all, I was looking at about that notion of the children of immigrants considering themselves Americans. I mean, if they were born here, they most certainly are. But I was looking at a 2013 Pew study of second-generation immigrants, or the children of immigrants. And it was fascinating because they found that across income scales, for example, the children of Hispanic immigrants and the children of Asian American immigrants, more than 60% of each group, 61% of them considered themselves typical Americans. So, I mean, I guess at least by that measure, they felt quite comfortable with the level of assimilation.
But when 100%, yes.
Yeah. And so when it comes to this question of like this sort of cultural assimilation, but also you're also talking about class as well. And I think perhaps there's some differing opinions on what you asserted. And I'll just quote this to you. Michael Fix of the Migration Policy Institute, he says that if you look at the second generation and higher and their children, when they become adults, the children of immigrants pay higher taxes and use fewer benefits than other natives and then other immigrants. So not all of them are necessarily stuck in that struggling working class that you were talking about.
It's really striking. So you mentioned 60%, 61%. Mm-hmm. Those numbers are really high, but of course there's a large group outside of that, right? And when you look to what Michael Fix is talking about, Michael Fix is a very important researcher. He's talking about averages, right? And when we're talking about immigration policy, when we're talking about it in a more granular fashion, we're not necessarily talking about the median person. The median household income in the United States is one thing. When we're looking at the fate of people in the bottom fifth, I must say I myself am pretty alarmed by it. And I don't say, aha, Raihan, but the median is this. Therefore, we don't have to worry about folks in the bottom fifth. In the bottom two-fifths. When I look at the United States right now, I see a situation where you have a very polarized experience of immigrant integration, in which you do have some people who, frankly, are lifting up the average for the larger population, partly because these are often folks who are drawn from superstar minorities in their native countries, very elite minorities, or they're coming from more affluent, urbanized countries. When you're looking at other folks who are drawn from different communities, they need a lot more help. They need a lot more intensive help. And the question is, how do we balance that against the integration challenge we already have from decades of immigration in the past? Balancing those considerations is really important. And when we look to averages, we risk missing the fact that there is a large group of people who really do feel marginalized. And by the way, you mentioned the second generation. Now, I don't like to talk in terms of Hispanic or Asian a lot, but the Pew Research Center does. And they showed that if you look at first generation Hispanic Americans, they are more likely to believe in the American dream than second-generation Hispanic Americans. I don't believe that those second-generation Americans are fools. I do not believe that they are lying. I believe that they are talking about struggles that they face. They are reckoning with those struggles, and they're seeing that, hey, my parents made this decision, they uprooted themselves, but I'm an American, and I do not feel as though I am getting ahead as I want to. And by the way, that's a pretty typical American experience for a lot of working-class and lower-middle-class folks.
So So to your point here, I'm seeing the same numbers from Pew, as you just quoted, that looking ahead, they say two-thirds of second-generation Hispanics, 41% of Asians, believe their own children, so third generation, will eventually surpass their current standard of living. Overall, 48% of American adults say the same. So they're sort of starting to attenuate and match the overall American average on that view. But to your point, can I just
one thing to keep in mind is that average is a moving average, right? That average is shaped when you're incorporating large groups of second generation folks and what have you. So that's an important thing to keep in mind.
But so the same is true then whenever we speak of any average across the United States.
Oh, yes. Right? Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so I guess the question that I have, and I promise you I want to spend quite a bit of time on sort of your set of solutions here. But because you're saying that we should, you know, pay special attention to working class immigrants or low-skilled, low-income immigrants and their children and the particular challenges they face, and if I'm reading you right, how those challenges are then further exacerbated by the current immigration policy. What I want to know, Raihan, though, is as I hear you, I think to myself, well, low wages, lack of a safety net, lack of social services. These are all things that most or many working class Americans, regardless of their immigration status, these are all challenges that they're facing. So if we're focusing on immigration, isn't that kind of a convenient way to ignore what might be the other drivers for these problems that we're talking about?
Well, thankfully, you know, I've written a book in which I talk about a lot of those issues. But the important thing to keep in mind is that immigration policy is discretionary. We as a country have an inherited legacy of segregation. We have a legacy in which we have not always offered the best services, the services that we ought to have offered to Americans who are struggling to break into the middle class. But when we look at immigration, it is discretionary. We have some choice over the folks that we admit into the country and how we approach their integration. Now, the really important thing to understand about immigration right now in 2018 versus in previous eras is that native birth rates are quite low. What that means is that when you're looking at immigration and the children of immigrants, that represents a really big chunk of the future workforce. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about these integration challenges, you need to be attuned to the fact that, you know, when we have these challenges that we're not reckoning with very well right now, that we're not dealing with very well right now, it might suggest, hey, we might need a more cautious and balanced and measured approach going forward, rather than assuming that assimilating into the working class is going to be just fine. It's going to go perfectly smoothly, as it did, let's say, in mid-century America, a time when the economy was far less punishing to working class people in all sorts of ways.
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is, how does making significant modifications to the current immigration system, how does that have any effect on, say, income inequality? Quality in America, which is definitely a driving force for a lot of the frustrations that people feel.
Well, first of all, I'm not so sure about that. I tend to think of inequality as a kind of secondary issue. What I do see as a big and important issue is between group inequality, when members of one group feel as though they're excluded and not properly represented in the upper strata of society, when they don't feel like they're given a proper chance. But more broadly, when you're talking about how it's affecting the safety net and much else, again, immigration is discretionary policy. We can talk about a variety of different market democracies. Some market democracies have done a much better job of integrating newcomers, of integrating immigrants than others. And one thing you see is that the societies that do the best job of integrating people fully into their middle class, fully into their societies, are those that take a more disciplined approach to selecting immigrants, to think about, you know, who are the people who are in a position to thrive in this modern knowledge-based economy. They might also welcome humanitarian immigrants, but in the United States, we have kind of a muddle between humanitarian and non-humanitarian immigration. And we can talk about that further, but that is a huge source of our problem. We're not thinking rigorously about that distinction.
Yeah. So let's talk about sort of your prescription for what you would like to see change. You go far beyond just sort of policy or mechanistic policy tweaks. I mean, you really are calling for in the book what you call like a new kind of nationalism. So or a sense of what it is to be American. But if I could break down your prescription here into three parts, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it does seem as if you're saying that, okay, on the one hand, and this might not please some hardliners on the right, that you think that we do need to offer some form of amnesty or path to citizenship for many immigrants already here, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then you also talk about modifying our current immigration policy and moving towards a merit-based system.
I don't use the term merit-based system. The only times I use the term merit in the book, I use scare quotes around it.
Okay.
Partly because I believe that there are many different kinds of immigrants who have merit. But the problem with our system right now is that it's very heavily biased towards those who are related to U.S. citizens or permanent residents.
Mm-hmm.
And that system does not allow us to take into account a variety of other factors that contribute to your adaptability. I try to take a somewhat subtle perspective on how one might incorporate family ties while also incorporating other dimensions of experience that could affect your integration experience.
Okay, so tell us more about that then. What would the new immigration system that you would like to see, what would it look like?
Well, there are lots of different components to it, but you know, one way to think about it is this. Right now, the United States has a wait list of over 4 million people who've had petitions for lawful permanent resident status that have been approved, but they're literally just waiting in line. Now, we do not have any way to prioritize among those folks who are on this list. And actually, when you look at our system, I mean, it's very jury-rigged. It dates from a long time ago. It hasn't really been modernized. When you look at some other countries, what they try to do is say, okay, we are going to look to past immigrants and what has contributed to their success, to their ability to flourish, to support their families, and much else. Let's identify some of these characteristics and use these to basically give would-be migrants, to give potential migrants some guidance on the kind of things that will help you succeed in the United States. And I think that that's a much wiser approach, because rather than creating some kind of total free-for-all in which migrants are frankly misled in some ways by our existing immigration system, you're actually giving them guidance and rules for the road as to how difficult it's going to be in some ways to integrate into an entirely different society.
Well, many times people point to Canada as an example.
I have some issues with the Canadian system, frankly, but yeah, certainly some people do point to Canada, and I think Canada's system has some good points and also some bad points.
So tell us what some of your issues are then. Because it just comes up again and again when people talk about a points-based system or merit-based or whatever, skills-based.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. So Canada and Australia are well known for having a points-based system. And I think there's a lot of virtue to a points-based system. But Canada also has what you might call a two-track system, in which you have a system for permanent immigration, which I think is reasonably good, though I might quibble with some aspects of it. And then they also have a pretty high volume of temporary migration. And what that winds up being is this kind of segregated system in which they admit lots of low-skill workers through the temporary system and higher-skill folks through the permanent system. That's a system a lot of people want for the United States, which I personally see as pretty problematic, as something that does not necessarily jibe with a lot of the ways Americans think about our society. So I see that as one flaw of the Canadian approach. And also the Canadian approach, you know, one can debate whether or not they are pushing it a bit too far in some ways in terms of numbers, and that's a debate that Canadians are having right now. But I think overall what's striking is that Canada admits far more immigrants relative to the United States, partly because they have a far more selective system.
Right, two and a half times per capita.
Yeah. Vastly, vastly more than the United States, Meghna. And that's actually becoming a really contentious issue right now after decades when migration was not a contentious issue in Canada. And again, the reason why that wasn't so contentious is because it was so skills-based. That was a big part of it. But again, when you look at those numbers, you've got to be careful about what's permanent and what's temporary, mm-hmm. and also how rigorously and frankly militant they enforce their immigration rules. I mean, there are rules on the books there that say that if you violate them, you could be imprisoned for up to a year. I mean, it is incredibly aggressive with their temporary programs. They will segregate men and women in some cases. I mean, they really can go quite far, and that's part of why they've preserved that consensus, because immigration enforcement in Canada is frankly so rigorous that I think that a lot of Americans, including American conservatives, would balk at their approach. So when people talk about the Canadian approach, some people focus on the high numbers. Hey, look, that's impressive. Other people say, look at the skills. Other people say, hey, look at the enforcement. We can all point to a different piece of it. Usually we get really oversimplified characterizations of it, focusing on just the numbers rather than the selective dimension of it and much else.
Rehan, let me ask you, though. I mean, Canada allows us to bring up a question here that, I mean, even if, so if the Canadian system with all its, you know, pros and cons, its skills-based what have you that you just talked about, even if that system is leading to, as you see it, some tensions in Canada, doesn't that bring us to the obvious question that many people listening to this and listening to sort of the beginning of your prescription for immigration as we're exploring, as no matter what changes you might recommend, that your ultimate goal is to simply reduce the amount of immigration and that they would reject that because they see that as, you know, American nativism at its worst.
Well, that's why it's really helpful for folks to read my book, because in the book I explicitly say I do not pursue a reduction in immigration levels, and I explain why. I believe that there can be a legitimate case for a reduction. And again, when I'm talking about the Canadian case, I'm merely saying that the system was pretty uncontroversial, has become somewhat more controversial now that you have government that's talking about pushing the numbers up. You even see The Economist, very much an advocate of immigration, saying that, hey, there's a case for treading lightly and not pushing too hard, lest you lead to a backlash. But again, in my book, I do not talk about reductions. I talk about rebalancing in ways that actually give helpful guideposts to potential migrants, rather than misleading migrants about their prospects and about what's likely to happen to them once they actually settle in the country. Our system right now is not doing a very good job, and I fear that that is causing lots of problems.
Mm. And so then, so we'll come back to this in a second, but before the break, we just got about 30 seconds to go. I want to just begin talking about the third part of your prescription here, which is really investing more in the American middle class, both native and foreign born.
Yes, that's right. There are lots of ways to think about this issue, and I really focus on one narrow specific aspect of it. I say I'm in favor of a universal child benefit, and this is something that would benefit a wide array of American families.
And if that means raising taxes on the wealthy, how might your fellow conservatives respond to that?
Well, I'm sure that there are people who'd object, and I'm sure there are other people who'd welcome it. But I think that, you know, if you do this in balanced fashion, it could do a great deal of good and also strengthen the legitimacy of a dynamic market economy.
All right. Well, we're speaking with Rehan Salam. He's author of the new book, Melting Pot or Civil War. A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. We'll get a bunch of callers in here right after the break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking this hour with Rehan Salam. He's executive editor of National Review and author of the new book, Melting Pot or Civil War, A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. And Rehan, we have a lot of callers who have some questions for you, so let's turn to some of them. Mary is calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. You're on the air, Mary.
Thank you for taking my call. I live in a city that does a lot of refugee resettlement. It also has a number of universities, so we have a really nice mix of diversity here where I live. And the one concern I have about moving to a more skills-based, especially higher skills-based, is that it neglects the needs of our agricultural folks who are really looking for employees, that a lot of Native Americans, for whatever reason, are not interested in taking their jobs. So the refugees really do help us in a community in terms of making sure that some of our larger employers are well-staffed. I also feel that in terms of the family element, that, and this is just my personal opinion, it might be easier for folks to assimilate if they have a family member here with them so that they can grow more in the community.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't feel that Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, Mary, your 2 points, actually, I want to give Raihan a chance to respond to them. So thank you for your call. The issue of not enough workers in some very important American sectors, they're coming up with Mary's call, Raihan, and your response to that.
Mary has raised a really rich and complicated set of issues, and I want to focus on the economic piece of it because I think that it's often misunderstood. So, first of all, it is 100% the case that there are many agricultural employers who do business in a certain way and are accustomed to doing business in a certain way who really do feel we have a labor shortage relative to the wages we are currently willing to pay. If those wages became substantially higher, they would necessarily have to change the way they do business. One way to think about this is about the price of gasoline. When the price of gasoline becomes much higher, people first start to change their commuting patterns. They might start carpooling. There are certain car trips that they might not take that they otherwise would have taken. And then over a longer period of time, after a year, 2, 3 years, they might start actually buying different kinds of cars or moving to more walkable neighborhoods. The economy can adapt and change to the labor force. But Mary also talks about refugees. Now, I do not talk about refugee resettlement in this book. I've written about it a bit for The Atlantic, and I think that's actually really important because right now, refugee immigration is a really separate and distinct issue from immigration writ large. I don't believe that it's appropriate to talk about skills when you're talking about refugee resettlement. But refugee resettlement represents actually a pretty small part of so-called low-skill immigration to the United States. A lot of the rest of it comes in non-humanitarian categories. So I guess my belief is that low-skill immigration, to the extent it's appropriate, should be humanitarian in nature and not non-humanitarian in nature. But I think that's a really important distinction to keep in mind. But on the economic question, if you look at different countries, their economies work differently. They bend in response to whether or not you want to be a high-wage, high-productivity economy, or if you allow employers to basically pursue a lower-wage, lower-productivity path.
So are you saying that changing immigration or changing the available workforce that's provided through immigration is the best way to raise those wages?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that the economy is dynamic and the economy will change in response to the skills mix of the workforce. There are all sorts, there are many countries around the world that have seen a dramatic increase in the educational attainment of their workforce. That hasn't suddenly meant that these countries cease to function properly. It hasn't meant that their economies shut down. What it means is that employers are forced to adapt to the workforce that is available to them. In 1960, South Korea's population was a lot less well-educated than it is today. It's not as though South Korea no longer has food. What you might do is you start importing food. That's really bad news for businesses that get crunched by that, businesses that depend on paying really low wages, but that's just something that happens in a dynamic market economy. We don't have a problem with it when it's, rich people who are imposing those changes on other people. But, I think that we have to recognize that, this dynamism works in all different directions. Yeah. We can adapt to those changes as we have in the past.
Well, let's go to Albert, who's calling from Miami, Florida. You're on the air, Albert.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. It's great to hear this discussion from Miami, which is a place where immigration is completely unmanaged in any sense of there is no we, there's no royal we deciding how things are going to happen here in Miami. And the interesting thing is it works incredibly well compared to folks around the world, countries like Germany or Sweden, who've attempted to bring in large numbers of immigrants, very carefully controlling the situation and where people live and whether they can work or not. Here in Miami, in my lifetime, there have been 3 occasions where around 100,000 people just kind of poured in, with the only kind of management happening by the immigrants themselves and our families and the Catholic Church and local governments, and it works. I mean, I just like to point out that we, and once again, a kind of a royal we, does not need to tell our Honduran friends who are deciding whether to come here what it'll be like, because they have telephones.
Yeah. Albert, thank you. Yeah, I'm just going to jump in here and thank you for your call, because Raihan, it sounds like Albert is very clearly pushing back against your notion that divisiveness is a growing possibility with low-wage, low-skilled immigrant communities. He's saying he's pointing to Miami as his people's exhibit A on how it works.
Oh, yeah. And I think that Miami is a really interesting case. Albert, I'm sure, knows far more about it than I do. It has, has a very large Spanish-speaking population, many flourishing enclaves. I think the thing to understand about Miami, though, is that Miami is a pretty inegalitarian place. It's a place where you have some communities that are pretty segregated, pretty separate from other places, where if you're living downtown, you live in a building with a doorman. If you're living in certain communities, you're living on a cul-de-sac where you're very far away from some areas that have pretty intense urban poverty. And when you are someone who lives what I call a curated life, when your experiences of diversity really are things that are entirely within your control, it can feel pretty great. But then there are other people who are not necessarily on the right end of that transaction, but who are on the wrong end of that transaction. People who feel as though, hey, I'm struggling, I'm working hard, you know, I'm here because I want to be here, but then their kids don't necessarily feel as though they're able to find themselves in those cul-de-sacs. They're not able to find themselves in those buildings with doormen and those gated communities. And I think that that's something that really does engender tension. But yeah, I mean, look, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. It's a place where we have lots of flourishing immigrant communities, and it's terrific. But I believe that when we're looking at these things on a multi-generational scale, when we're looking at the feeling of exclusion that a lot of people have, and Albert doesn't have it, and I appreciate that. You know, I don't have it. But I think that there are a lot of other people who do. And even if they're a minority, those people matter to me.
Mm. But the feeling of exclusion, though, I mean, it doesn't, maybe this is what you're saying, but it isn't part of, isn't one of those reasons why they have that feeling is because of the surrounding community that isn't welcoming to them.
Well, part of what happens, Meghna, is that when you have a large amount of inward migration, you might also have outward migration to other regions. So what you see happen in a particular city, in a county, is one thing in terms of this dynamic response over time. The people who happen to like the way that Miami is right now stay there. Other folks who find that it's become too expensive, who find that it's become difficult for them to feel like they can break into the middle class, if, let's say, they're second generation or third generation, those people will often move to Orlando or Hialeah, they'll move to Tallahassee, they'll move to other places. So in a way, you get this portrait of beautiful harmony, but you're actually looking at it rather differently when you're looking at it from a national perspective, and also when you're looking at that intergenerational transmission. And what I fear is that you see an intergenerational transmission of privilege and advantage among some people, and you see an intergenerational transmission of poverty among other people. And from the perspective of a kind of middle class, upper middle class suburbanite who has a curated experience of all of these things, you could have one perspective, but there are a lot of other folks who are trying to think about the long term and whether or not you can have a nation of gated communities and folks who live outside of those communities and whether or not that's something that's really going to work.
Yeah, you know, I mean, everything that you just said, I think we could have that exact conversation simply about class. And I asked you this before, but maybe it's just because I don't get it. And not about immigration. I mean, I agree with everything that you just said, but it just doesn't, I still don't fully see how immigration is a big force.
Well, Meghna,
it's actually
pretty darn important when you're thinking about how much it contributes to the composition of the population, number one. And number two, when you see those moments in American history where you actually have had a sense of solidarity, when you have had that kind of wider concern, it's often been after you've had a more managed approach to immigration. I don't believe that that's a coincidence. Mm-hmm. I believe that there is a connection because, again, you're not talking about a trivial number of folks. When you're looking at first and second generation Americans, you're looking at a quarter of the population. And when you're looking at folks who are struggling, folks who are lower income, a very large proportion of them are first or second generation. It's not as though the issue of class can be abstracted away from the question of what are our future flows? What are our future immigration policies going to look like?
Mm. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Fairfax, Virginia. You're on the air, Alex.
Hey, I just wanted to make a quick case for open borders in relation to ethics and the global poor. Our capitalist society offers a lot more opportunity for upwards economic mobility than many other less affluent countries. So regardless of what it means to be an American, I think, I guess my relatively uneducated opinion on this is that the risk of open borders being stuff like crime and tax complications and even marginalization among others is far outweighed by the good that it does for thousands of people a year who could not have imagined a better life than living in the U.S.
Alex, thank you for your call. Raihan, you want to respond to him?
Alex talks about thousands of people a year, but it's really important to understand that when you're talking about true openness on that scale, you would be talking about much larger numbers. And also, it's really important to keep in mind that new immigrants, they don't chiefly compete with natives. They chiefly compete with previous immigrants with similar skill sets. And that's one reason why, when you look at that period at the very beginning of the 20th century, the 1900s, the 19-teens, before you had an immigration restriction, you saw very little upward mobility among previous immigrants in the United States. It was only in mid-century America when you turned away from openness, for some bad reasons as well as some good reasons, when you actually saw really pronounced upward mobility among those folks who were foreign-born. So I think that, openness sounds really appealing if you're someone who's going to have a curated, gated kind of experience. But if you're someone who is actually in the trenches competing, if you're an immigrant yourself, then it looks very different from that vantage point a lot of the time. Mm.
Raihan, though, there's something that that Alex, the caller, mentioned that got me thinking, and I think he's also getting to what he conceives as a basic American value, right? That this is a place, or the place, the whole, whether or not you believe it's myth or reality, of the American dream is possible, that anybody can come to the United States and be given at least the opportunity for a better life. Now, look, we've got comments on our website right now, people disagreeing with what I just said. We've got someone calling themselves Eminem who says, Eminem's got a problem with both you and me, Raihan, saying the problem with immigrants is that they are completely brainwashed into the American dream. I mean, but isn't the question of like what kind of country we want to be also at the heart of what you're thinking through?
Yes, and I've got to say, when I look at American history, I believe that it's those moments of solidarity, it's those moments of compromise, it's those moments when we decide we are going to do something, we're going to be hard-headed, we're going to be balanced, we're going to be measured. Those were the periods that formed a basis for lasting prosperity. I don't believe that mid-century America, I don't believe that the New Deal was un-American. That was a departure from this spirit of openness that Alex described, but I believe that that was a period that was actually vitally important to creating a wider, more inclusive sense of what America is. If you're looking at the civil rights movement, that happened at a time when the United States felt like, look, we're fighting a Cold War and we cannot betray these people who've been left behind in our own society, partly just because it looks bad, partly because it's morally outrageous. But when you feel as though, well, no, we don't actually have to be dependent on this population because, look, we can just open ourselves up. If these folks don't prove sufficiently pliable or sufficiently, kind of helpful for our narrow purposes, then we'll just look elsewhere. And I think that that is a pretty dangerous attitude. Immigrants have children. And when those children stumble, when those children need help, we ought to lift them up. But right now, this attitude of kind of openness being the heart of our identity, rather than the idea that, hey, we are a country, we are a kind of extended community in which we look out for one another. I think that that latter sensibility built around communitarianism, built around solidarity, actually has a lot of value. That does not mean being completely closed. That means being open, but being open in a sensible, measured way, rather than being open to the point where you then invite a backlash, you create new tensions and new cleavages within the society that make it really hard to actually build communities.
Mm. We've just got 2 minutes to go here, Raihan. And, you are talking through a nuanced view of future immigration policy. You're calling for amnesty on the one hand, about changes in exactly who and how we let in, and then also, as you talked about, like lifting up the children of people who are here, whether they're native or foreign born. I mean, I guess I should ask you finally a very practical question. I appreciate this plan that you're laying out here, but it's purely theoretical at the moment because there seems to be no appetite in Washington whatsoever for any kind of compromise that makes some happy and makes everybody happy and makes everybody also a little unhappy. So, we could talk until we're blue in the face, but it doesn't seem like there's a practical way forward.
There were a lot of people who ridiculed the idea that someone like Bernie Sanders would become a leading figure in American politics. There were people who thought the idea of Donald Trump as president was absolutely ludicrous. There are people who dismiss all sorts of ideas. And I understand that sounds really clever. That sounds really cynical. It sounds really great. It sounds like you're in the know. But I guess my limited experience, having been in this line of work for a while, is that, the public surprises you, politics will surprise you, and what you have to do is just have certain convictions, make the case for them as honestly and clearly as you can, and hope that people will listen.
I mean, is that possible? Sorry, last 30 seconds. Is that possible when we also have immigration issues tied up so closely with what people see as flat-out racism?
I think that there are a lot of folks on the left and the right who seek to malign and misrepresent the people on the other side. As someone who is making the case for a more measured immigration policy, I hear people accuse me of all sorts of things, including of racism. But you just have to speak the truth as you see it and hope that people will see through that.
Well, Raihan Salam, the new book is Melting Pot or Civil War, A Son of Immigrants Makes the Case Against Open Borders. He's also executive editor of National Review. Raihan, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Meghna.
It was great to talk with you. We've also got an excerpt of Raihan's book at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.